This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. For 30 years, the Princeton Review has been publishing a comprehensive list of what they determine to be the best colleges in the country. The rankings are the result of thousands of interviews with students and in-person visits to campuses. The latest version has just been released, called The Best 387 Colleges. Because of the COVID pandemic, the in-person visits had to be curtailed for this edition, so the review added a section of great lists to the book, listing items like colleges with great career services, great financial aid, even the happiest students. To talk about this year's edition of the book, we invited back Rob Franek, the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review, and we started by pointing out that last year's book had 386 colleges, so there was one addition to the list.
You know, we add some and subtract some each year, so I think it was that we removed four and added five this year. So we try to, keep it fresh and keep all of these and continue to get fresh data from school.
Now, this year, you've also undertaken a survey of college admission officers. I want to talk about that first. What did you talk about in this survey?
Well, a couple of different things. We launched the survey end of July, the 22nd of July, and we ended it on August 5th. And it was really college administrators giving their guidance on what was going to happen for reopening plans, COVID policies on campus, mandates or not mandates of vaccination policies on campus. So things that students and parents likely would need to know for fall of 2021, but that so many high school students and their parents who are still in high school, are hoping to know for the next academic year. So it's been really interesting. I think just to give some personal solace to folks out there, should they be showing up to campus this week, or a lot of students came onto campus last week, that 96% of the administrators said that classes were going to be, or school was going to open for in-person classes, but those classes were likely going to be hybrid. And it was the majority, 67% said hybrid classes, which would be a combination of in-person and, of course, online.
Were there any findings in this survey that just kind of stood out to you?
One, that 96% of campuses that were going to reopen was so stark because the last year it was 75% less for the fall of 2020. And I know, Bob, you and I spoke about this in the past, but still when the numbers reveal, even for a guy like me that's been talking about education for a long time, it still feels tectonic, but such a breath of solace for so many students, parents, but also administrators, faculty members, and other staff on college campuses across the country.
Do you think that the COVID situation has accelerated the amount of schools that are going test optional?
Oh, it has, without question. Yeah. I mean, and that's one thing that we asked on the survey. We did a similar survey in the summer of 2020 as well. And this is just anecdotal information that we collected Princeton Review for test optional. And just so that everybody understands what test optional nomenclature means is that, students needn't submit their SAT or ACT scores for academic admission, but it doesn't prohibit students from submitting those scores. So 87% of all the schools that responded to our survey this year said for their policies over the last year for fall of 2021, those students that are showing up onto campus now, that they were test optional. But if a student submitted their SAT or ACT scores, that school would consider it in their admission process. And for many of those schools, for scholarship dollars as well. So, I mean, that to me is significant. Now, those same schools said in fall of 2021, that they would likely be test optional, but only 78% of those schools said they would be test optional come the next academic year for fall of 2022 admission.
So more schools are going to start requiring those test scores again next year.
You have it exactly. Yeah. And I think that's something that, so many of my students continue to ask about. And anyway, so now we're giving some good guidance on what administrators are feeling right now on campus and setting policies.
There's one survey that you do almost every year that you couldn't do this year, and that was asking students about their campus experience, because there wasn't much of one, was there?
You're right. I mean, this is the 30th year we've been putting out this book, and obviously the new edition for the best 387 colleges, but the previous 29 editions were all based on student surveys about their experiences on campus, academically, quality of life, food, residence halls, everything that would likely affect a student's quality of life. But since schools were largely suspended from in-person classes and in-person residential life on campus, we had to suspend the survey. So we removed our 62 top 20 ranking lists that are the bedrock for those previous editions. And we've replaced them this year with 26 great lists. So that's a look back on 30 years of time since it just coincided with our 30th anniversary. So it's really, I think, some pretty interesting stuff. Schools that have perennially been superlative on so many of our ranking lists.
And some of those lists are interesting. You have top 50 colleges for game design, for entrepreneurial studies. What went into the thinking of putting those lists together?
Well, we got some very clear guidance from college-bound students and their parents. And we asked them to give us guidance on what were the most important lists that we had in the past at Princeton Review that helped them find a school, college or university, that was going to be a best fit for them. Best fit academically, best fit financially, best fit campus culture or career services. And those were the ranking lists, the great lists, as we've termed them this year, that we put together. So you'll see, you know, great career services, great financial aid. That's particularly important this year. I've been talking about that for, you know, all day, and I suspect will throughout the fall. But things that are incredibly important to what students and parents are feeling right now as they go through the college process.
Is enrollment up across the board?
Well, it is for fall of 2021. And that's another thing that we had asked on this on the administrator survey. And it was significant when we think about the numbers of schools that said that they were up. So out of the 300 or just shy of 300 colleges that responded to our survey, 43% said that their enrollments were up for fall of 2021. 35% said they were flat. And 22% said that they were down. And I think, Bob, when you and I spoke the last time, it was those schools. It's kind of interesting because the public and private school mix, particularly for schools that are seeing a decrease in enrollment, is specifically focused on many public schools. Last year, since we were in the height of the pandemic, many families, and of course students included, felt the pinch, the financial pinch of COVID. And as a result, many students were focused not on private schools, but are attending public schools because of the lower sticker costs. Now, sometimes that doesn't work out because private schools have greater financial wherewithal, generally speaking, and could have made it, you know, that much more valuable for students from a financial aid perspective. But we're seeing that change in this year's survey results.
One of the surveys that you took was mandating students be vaccinated if they're living on campus. And when I looked at the results, the geographical breakdown was pretty stark.
It is pretty stark. You're right. Overall, it's 64% of all campuses that we had surveyed said that they were requiring a mandate for vaccines for all students on campus. But you're right. It's the regional differentiation that's so interesting. 88% of schools in the Great Northeast are embracing the vaccination mandate. Only, and on the low side of the fence, Southeastern schools, 48% said that they were embracing the mandate. So, and now we have a nice regional representation, five different regions, but those were the lows and the highs.
So as you put this book together, just how much did you have to, you know, make it up as you went along after this 2020 season?
Well, we started actually to survey students on campus in the late part of September, early part of October of 2020. And as we had talked about, we were getting back results from students because our survey is in large part online, but those students weren't able to speak to their in-person experience, their on-campus experience. And that's really the lifeblood of the book. So we quickly pivoted to thinking about, well, we've been doing this stuff a long time. I know over our 30 years now that we're celebrating with this edition of the book, you know, we have a little over 2.7 million surveys from college-bound students over time. You know, we produced over 10,000 different ranking lists over time. So we have some deep experience. And I believe that these great lists are still able to inform. And I spend most of my time on the road talking to students, parents, and counselors throughout the academic year. And I'm already feeling it from the virtual talks that we're giving. And then I suspect the same thing is going to happen this fall.
You going to be able to get actually on the road this time?
So it seems, you know, a couple schools have gone back virtual, but yeah, I my first gig is right after Labor Day. So I'll stay in contact, but it's, yeah, I have a full schedule. I'm talking over 50 schools this fall. So yeah, just looking forward to it.
And what did you find that they were saying, administrators were saying were the biggest concerns or the biggest, their big focus starting this school year?
Yeah, I'm so appreciative of bringing it up. We asked administrators to, you know, rate the concerns on campus from a student perspective. What are their students concerned about, and then what are they as administrators and their peer administrators concerned about? And we asked them to look at five things: academics, affordability, a perennial favorite, health, and then social justice. So access and equity issues on campus. And the administrators were united in saying that the number one concern for both students as well as administrators was academics on campus. But as we talked about before, it's not the regional difference here that's interesting, it's the public and private school difference that's interesting. So some private schools in certain regions voted academics as number one, and some focused on affordability for students. And similar numbers for administrator surveys, academics, and then of course health is a big concern for administrators.
Any of them talking about retention, just getting students back who might not have come back in 2020?
Well, they are. And the way that those administrators are talking about it is specifically through financial aid. You know, as we know, affordability is so key. And I know many times that we've talked in the past, Bob, we talked about an annual survey that we have at Princeton Review called College Hopes and Worries. This past March was the 17th annual edition of this data coming out. And the biggest concern for students and families is the amount of debt that they'd likely incur to pay for college and then getting into their first choice schools, but families wouldn't be able to pay for it. So all around that financial aid and cost of college. But to answer your question, that is how I'm seeing that administrators are focusing on it. They're saying, listen, if you apply to our school and you're admitted, then there are any number of ways we can make it affordable for you as a family. Just last year alone, private schools were able to meet demonstrated financial need 99%, public schools at 91%. So these are colossal numbers. And when I think about it, when I talk to young people and their families who might not be so sure if there's going to be money out there for them, I think that there is a warm kind of bear hug of solace there and saying that there is financial aid, both from the school as well as from the federal and state governments.
That's Rob Franek, the editor-in-chief of the Princeton Review. This year's publication is called The Princeton Review's Best 387 Colleges. Still to come, a special boot camp has been created that helps military veterans adjust to a return to the classroom. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Veterans Administration spends more than $13 billion a year on educational benefits for vets, and the agency has a new way to help ensure that those who use the money to enroll in college succeed both academically and socially. It's partnering with a nonprofit group called the Warrior Scholar Project that runs academic boot camps. Jay Price reports for the American Homefront Project.
Yeah, we'll just create like a working draft, implementing some of the easy changes from last night.
About a dozen veterans and active duty troops in a University of North Carolina classroom listen intently as Hillary Lithgow, an associate professor of English, helps them refine the essays they've been writing on the philosophical underpinnings of American democracy.
And we're going to fit in just the last couple of pieces about citations, titles.
Right up front is Master Gunnery Sergeant Eric Gonzalez, tattooed and heavily muscled. He's been in the Marine Corps for 23 years. Later, during a break, Gonzalez says when he retires from the Corps in a few years, he wants to enroll in a four-year college to become a physical therapist.
The Marine Corps has given me the work ethic. I just want to find different ways to use those tools that I've been given.
That's why he signed up for the boot camp and made the drive from Camp Lejeune. And that distance wasn't just measured in miles. The gulf between the distinctive cultures of the military and academia can be daunting for veterans who may not have been in a classroom for decades and who worry how they'll fit in among classmates who might be the same age as their children. One of the project's goals is to bridge that gap.
The encouragement that they give, like, you know, being 41-year-old student, you know, going to college, you know, I'm a little hesitant to ask questions because I don't want to say something dumb or feel embarrassed or already go to the stereotype as a big dumb Marine.
About 1,600 veterans and troops transitioning out of service have used the boot camps. About 90% of them have graduated or are on track to. 21 colleges and universities host boot camps, including the likes of Harvard, Yale, and Williams. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, many are online for now, but when done in person, the host institutions provide the classrooms, meals, and housing, and the Warrior Scholar Project, which is donor-funded, covers the rest. The VA is partnering with the program, hoping to improve the return on the higher education benefits it gives veterans.
This is a benefit that they've earned and they worked hard for. And we want to make sure that if there are available resources to them that's out there that could help them to set them up for success, we want to be a part of that.
Charmaine Bogue is Executive Director of Education Service for the Veterans Benefits Administration. The new partnership means the VA will help get the word out to veterans about the Warrior Scholar Project. The boot camps center around humanities, especially skills in analytical reading and academic writing, and have sessions on transitioning to academic life. Some also include a focus on business or science and math. Lithgow, the professor teaching the UNC boot camp writing workshop, has worked with the project since 2015.
There are a lot of reasons why I do it. The main reason is it's what teaching is supposed to be. You know, you have a classroom full of really motivated students who are just all they want to do is learn and do better. It's what you would hope for in every classroom, but you don't always get.
Gonzalez, the Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant, has had college courses before and said he did well, but sometimes found his approach to the work grueling. But the boot camp, he says, has helped. The first couple of nights he tackled assignments the way he does in the Marine Corps, going over something repeatedly until he's figured it out thoroughly. That worked, but kept him up till 2 a.m. Then the lessons started to sink in.
With the tips they gave through the analytical reading, I'm doing the same quality of work in a third of the time. So just those little things that the professor has gone over, it's awesome. Like the light bulb went off, I'm like, wow, okay.
Okay, meaning now he feels ready not just for getting through college, but doing well at it. I'm Jay Price reporting.
And this story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Every so often, I get to have an interesting conversation with a visiting professor who comes to speak to students. Earlier this month, that was Dr. Richard Dougherty, a professor of politics at the University of Dallas. He was giving a talk for an annual Constitution Day address, and the topic was the Roman philosopher Cicero.
I guess I would say, I've been teaching Cicero for, about 35 years now. What I find interesting about him is that he doesn't seem to have an agenda. You know, he's not trying to hammer things down your throat. He typically writes dialogues, as Plato wrote dialogues. And that result of that is it compels you to think about what he's saying or what the characters in the dialogue are saying, rather than just sort of trying to figure out what it is he's saying and then repeating that as if it were like a school of philosophy that he is trying to start. So he is the first major Roman Latin thinker to engage in philosophic discussions. And so much of the language that we have in English, for much of the philosophic language we have in English, actually comes from Cicero's translation of Greek terms. So he's very influential. He was one of the major authors read by every educated person in the West for the last, 1,500 years at least. So he's had a significant influence on virtually every thinker and time frame that we can think of.
And he was also quite the politician in his day, right?
Yes, and I think that's part of what makes it really interesting, makes him really interesting as a read for us. That is, he's not simply someone who sits in a corner or in a study and write. He was very much engaged, a leader, in fact, of the very late Roman Republic.
As you read about his history, and I don't know if I'm just being influenced by the musical, but he seems to remind me of Alexander Hamilton.
I have not thought about that, but that is that's pretty interesting. Certainly in the sense that he was a thoughtful person who was very influential on major policy decisions being made at the highest level. That's certainly true. And a character, right? So someone who people criticized or defended publicly, made a name for himself. So we might, sometimes if you think about someone like Hamilton, today we tend to speak of people as sort of public intellectuals, you know, someone who's in the public sphere and writing and thinking and talking about such things. And in that way, they're certainly similar.
Well, I thought of it, he writes like crazy, and he made a very bad political enemy and it ended up killing him.
That's right. But one of the things I think that is interesting and important is, he makes an enemy, but he has a choice to make. The choice is between Pompey and Caesar. And so, so Pompey is the other leader of Rome, and it's clear that there is a battle that's going to happen between Pompey and Caesar. And Cicero chooses to go with Pompey. And the reason he does is he thinks that Pompey is right, that is, that his position is the just one, and that Caesar's is not. But that's a choice I think that everyone might think about, right? Because there are other people who might decide, well, I know that Caesar is wrong, but if I go with him, maybe I can lessen the bad things that he does, right? Maybe I can reduce the evil that might come from his rule. And so it really is a prudential decision, I think, at that point that you have to make, right? Will you do more good for Rome, right? Because that's clearly what he's thinking of, what Cicero is thinking of. Will you do more good for Rome by siding with the one who you think is right, sort of in standing on principle, we might say, or softening that a bit as a way of mitigating the evil that might be done by someone like Caesar.
Now, in the end, Caesar actually pardoned Cicero, didn't he? And he did become part of that ruling class for a bit.
Yeah, that's right. So it turns out that, you know, in the very late Roman Republic, you know, the latter years right before the death of Caesar, I would say, the best thing to do would be to oppose Caesar and then join him. And he will give you a prime position in the government. That's just, you know, what was the mark of Caesar was the mercy that he showed to his opponents and really came to, if not trust them, at least reward them in a way for having abandoned their opposition to him.
Unfortunately, Mark Antony didn't have that kind of thinking.
No, Mark Antony did not take that approach, right?
When you give and I imagine you've given this talk before, what do students latch on to? What do they want to know from you afterwards?
Yeah, I guess the main thing would be, you know, certainly if we're thinking about our own circumstances and constitutional order, et cetera, you know, what might we learn from not just Cicero, but the others who were around him at the time, because we are talking about the very, very end of the Roman Republic. And Cicero is in the position, I would say, of thinking that the Republic can be saved. It can be restored in some way, maybe not exactly what it was like 10 years before that or 100 years before that, but something like that. And so his focus is clearly on, I think, trying to find a plan and a set of principles that can unite us rather than divide us. And I, you know, given the divisions that we have in contemporary politics in America, I think that's an enticing for many people, maybe not for everyone, those who are interested in perpetuating those divisions. But for many people, it's, you know, an attempt to find something where we can have a community. You know, we can have a political order with some kind of stability and peace. And that's really, I think, what Cicero is striving for.
Dr. Richard Dougherty is a professor of politics at the University of Dallas. How can colleges create culturally competent campuses? That's the alliterative topic for today's Academic Minute.
How do we create a culturally competent campus? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jacqueline Wiersma-Mosley, professor of human development and family sciences at the University of Arkansas, details the steps.
One effective tool that could help support, sustain, and strengthen diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts on college campuses is the Intercultural Development Inventory, or the IDI. The IDI framework can foster cultural competence among students, faculty, and staff to recognize their own cultural identity and to interact effectively and appropriately with people from other cultures. The IDI includes 5 stages of development. Starting first is denial, which reflects limited experience and capability understanding and responding appropriately to cultural differences. The best strategy is to increase awareness and visibility of cultural differences. Next is polarization, which is an us versus them mindset. Here, there's an overemphasis and judgment of racial differences, which stems from the fear of loss of power, privilege, and control. The best strategy is to find commonalities among groups. The majority of students, faculty, and staff are likely within minimization, which is highlighting commonalities too much that can mask a deeper understanding of cultural differences, often referred to as colorblindness. The best strategy for these individuals is to focus more on equity rather than equality. Next, individuals in acceptance recognize and appreciate patterns of cultural differences, but lack the ability to adapt to cultural differences. The best strategy is to continue engaging in cultural experiences. Lastly, adaptation is when one is able to successfully bridge cultural differences. Here, individuals have developed deep awareness of their own privileges, have a critical understanding of social issues, and have hands-on experience working for social change. In closing, the IDI supports learning that is both appropriate and challenging, and could help college campuses with their goals related to increasing diversity, equity, and inclusion.
That was Jacqueline Wiersma-Mosley of the University of Arkansas. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.